Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ryan Malone from Ropes and Gray. We've been appointed by the Court as counsel for the appellant. Your Honors, the government's entire case against Ms. Andrews is that she was friends with her co-defendant, Peter Turner, from whom she received a check for $1,000 that said loan, that she had access to a room where a forged beneficiary form was found, and that nearly 5 years after the fact, she made allegedly false or suspicious statements to federal investigators that were not corroborated in the notes that those investigators took during the interview. Now, we submit that this evidence as a matter of law was insufficient to sustain her convictions. But also, Your Honors, we submit that this case is so weak that there's a reasonable likelihood the jury would have acquitted had the government satisfied its Brady obligation and produced these notes of the investigators. And finally, Your Honor, there's nothing in the indictment or the evidence that demonstrates there's any criminal act that happened after February 2001. And as a result, the use of the 2006 sentencing guidelines to sentence Ms. Andrews violated the ex post facto clause. If I could, Your Honors, I'd like to turn first to the Brady argument. The government was under a court order to produce all Brady material before trial. That's not contested. They did not produce the handwritten notes of the investigator, Agent Chantel Robinson, until the fourth day of trial. When these notes were produced, they were revealed to have certain discrepancies from Chantel Robinson's testimony. Specifically, they did not include some of the suspicious statements to which Chantel Robinson had testified that Ms. Andrews made during that interview. If these notes had been turned over in a timely manner, they could have been used to impeach Agent Robinson. And because her testimony was so crucial, because the rest of the evidence was so weak, Your Honors.
Can I ask two questions? When you say that some of the statements attributed to the defendant weren't in there, you mean one of the statements, right?
Your Honor, there were actually two statements that were not in there.
In her notes?
Yes. Well, in both agents'
notes.
Well,
I'll just focus on Robinson for
yes.
The minute. I thought there were three statements altogether attributed to her, two of which were in the notes and one not. Is that wrong?
That's incorrect, Your Honor. There were four statements, and there were two that were not in the
notes.
Which
were the four?
The first statement was that she had never received any money from Mr. Turner. The second statement, which was the statement that the government pointed to during closing argument, was that she had received a check so that she could demonstrate she had a checking account. That didn't make any sense, and the government pointed that out. The third was that she had, in fact, received a loan from Mr. Turner for
$1,000. That's all I remember. What's the fourth?
Well, the fourth, Your Honor, was that she had paid Mr. Turner back that loan during that month. And that statement was not in the notes either. And that was a crucial fact to going to whether this was a payment or a loan. Because the government said, well, there's no way she could have paid back this loan during the month as she claimed.
She didn't testify, did she? Or did she?
No, she didn't, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
In other words, the notes did not have that statement.
Correct, Your Honor.
That she paid, but the notes said it was a loan, though.
The notes do contain the statement that says there was a loan made, yes.
Yes. And what about the testimony?
And Agent Robinson testified that Ms. Andrews eventually said that there was a loan of $1,000. The question was, Your Honor, how quickly she paid that back, because the government said she wasn't making enough money to pay it back as quickly as she said she did. And that was another statement that was not in the notes, but was testified to by the agent.
Now, the defense counsel never said there was a Brady violation, is that right?
Your Honor, he didn't use those words. However, when he found out about the notes during cross-examination, he immediately called a bench conference.
Yeah, he asked for the notes.
Yes, for the
notes.
That's
not the same thing as saying after looking at the notes that it was a Brady violation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's not the same thing as saying that I want the notes under Brady as compared to I want them under Jenks.
That's also correct, Your Honor. But he had no
argued they weren't producible. It's not correct.
The government, yes, Your Honor. The government said they had already produced the notes because
the
they were. Yes, the prosecutor said they'd already produced the notes because they were consistent with the report.
Right.
Now we know that they're not.
Mr. Silver never tried to cross-examine again based on the notes.
That's correct, Your Honor. But even if the court concludes that he made a mistake and failed to appreciate the value of those notes, That shouldn't excuse the government's Brady obligation. This court has said that sometimes it's necessary to produce Brady materials before trial.
Well, the question is whether or not it would have materially reduced his ability to get this across, given the time at which it was produced, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So Mr. Silver apparently didn't think that the notes were worth using at the time. I'm not sure I understand why they would have been more effective, or why. The question isn't whether they've been more effective. The question was why they would have been ineffective if he had either recalled the witness to finish the cross, or if he had just put in the notes as an inconsistent statement, and maybe the judge would have allowed him to do that since the government was late, and then the government's witness wouldn't have even been able to respond.
Your Honor, I don't agree that we can necessarily conclude that Mr. Silver appreciated the notes and made the type of strategic decision you're talking about.
Well, we don't know one way or the other. I mean, had Mr. Silver made a Brady objection below, that would have been on the record. And since it's not, that's another reason why we have to consider this as a plain error problem, because the kinds of issues you're talking about are ones that could have only been brought out in the district court, unless you think he was ineffective. In which case we could have remanded for an argument on ineffectiveness, but you didn't make that argument.
That's right, Your Honor. We did not argue that he was constitutionally ineffective.
Right.
At the same time, Your Honor, Mr. Silver did ask for the notes in a bench conference, and the district judge interrupted him and said, I think I know what you're going to say. Where are the notes? And this court has held that you don't need to make a specific objection if it's clear what act you want the court
to take. Well, the district court thought he was talking about Jenks, not Brady.
That may be, Your Honor.
But nobody could know whether they were Brady until we see them, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So once they were seen, nobody said they were Brady.
Once they were seen, nobody said they were Brady.
That's right. I mean, that is, you can't make a Brady argument about something you haven't seen yet, right? They can't say, I mean, maybe the notes would have been completely consistent. In fact, the government's argument is that they are completely consistent.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's precisely why Mr. Silver couldn't have said, I object to these notes.
Well, but when he got them, he could have. In fact, at any point after that, he could have, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The notes are only like 3 pages long, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
It's not as if somebody has to be, you know, looking through 10,000 pages to find the inconsistency.
The notes are not long, Your Honor, but they were produced in the middle of trial at the beginning before the jury was brought in on the fourth day.
Right.
And with the government continuing to represent that there were no discrepancies.
Right, but Mr. Silver can read. My question is, why do you say that they were materially less useful as cross-examination or as an exhibit at that point than if he had had them before? Than if Mr. Silver had had them before?
Because of the timing of the disclosure in the middle of the trial, Your Honor.
But why? That just because it's in the middle of trial doesn't mean that it can't be effectively used.
Because he would have had to recall the testimony from the day before and understand exactly what statements were not in the notes and compare them side by side. He did not have the opportunity to look at the notes.
He could have asked for a recess. He could have asked for a continuance. He could have done anything.
That's right, Your Honor. And he probably should have.
But well, that comes close to arguing de facto ineffective assistance of counsel, which you don't have in your argument.
I don't agree, Your Honor, because the court has held that sometimes Brady material needs to be produced before trial. And in this case, there was an order to produce that Brady material before
but
trial.
Your argument assumes that he didn't see what you see, right? And how can we assume that?
Well, even if he did see what we now know, Your Honor, he was put in a situation where he would have had to recall the government's
So what
witness.
She had just testified before, she wouldn't have to, all you're calling her for is to continue your cross-examination.
Well, the cross-examination had ended the night before, Your Honor.
Yes, but presumably you've been in trial and you know that there are many times when doesn't manage to make it all the way finished by the end of the day and you finish the next morning, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so what was the problem with, in many trials, cross-examination is more than one day. If it ends at the end of one day, you start up the next day, and here he would have a big zinger in your view. Why? What's the problem with presenting a zinger in the morning instead of in the afternoon?
Your Honor, I agree that it may be that Mr. Silver should have appreciated the value of the notes even at that time. But if you conclude that he did not, that fact alone should not excuse the government's failure to produce and comply with the court order.
No, the question is whether
to explain to the judges on this panel what two statements were not in the notes. Now, we've all looked at the notes, and least we tend to have indicated that we didn't see what you saw.
Yes.
All right. So to the extent Mr. Silver can read and appreciate in the middle of trial, and he did say, did he not, that if the government recalled Agent Robinson, then he might use the notes.
He did say that, Your Honor.
What was his thinking in that regard?
It's hard to say, Your Honor, but
No, but I mean, why would the government, if you think, presumably rebuttal? I mean, only the co-defendant testified.
It may have been, Your Honor, that he didn't want to call Agent Robinson to the stand again.
Oh, I can understand that from a defense point of view, but I just want to be clear what he might have had in mind. But the government has called Robinson. He's testified. He's finished his cross for all intents and purposes.
Yes.
All right.
Your Honor, if I could, I'd like to turn to the sufficiency of the evidence argument. The government pointed to four pieces of evidence, and every one of these pieces of evidence is insufficient as a matter of law. They rely on mere association and access to the file room. There were 12 other people who had access to that same file room. These were people who actually worked in the department where the files were kept. They point to the check. The check on its face said it was a loan, and Andrew's story, according to Agent Robinson, was that this was a loan to buy a car. The government subpoenaed her DMV records, and in fact, she did buy a car in March 2001. And finally, Your Honor, they pointed to these same statements that were made to Agent Robinson, and they said these lies were ludicrous and preposterous. They were evidence that Ms. Andrews was the insider who helped Mr. Turner. But that's not the law. False exculpatory statements are as indicative that you're trying to distance yourself from a criminal as it is indicative that you're part of the criminal conspiracy. The evidence here is just so thin.
You don't exclude that evidence. Or at least one court has said it's by itself it wouldn't be inculpatory, but this isn't by itself, is it?
It's not by itself, Your Honor, but taking this evidence together is just piling inference upon inference. It doesn't add up.
You don't think there's enough for the jury to conclude, reasonable jury to conclude that she was guilty?
No, Your Honor. Reasonable inferences should be given to the government, but some of these were unreasonable inferences. The government argued during closing argument that this was evidence that pointed to her criminal activity, and it simply is not. Every piece of this evidence, her personal friendship with Mr. Turner proves nothing. Her access to the file room, Mr. Turner himself was a regular at the hospital. He was known to every employee who worked at the hospital who was called as a witness. He could have easily gone in there himself. He didn't need an insider. So, Your Honors, I would submit that this is a very strong insufficiency case, and when you look at the evidence, it's just too thin to hold up to support these claims. And finally, Your Honors, I'd like to talk about the sentencing argument just very briefly. The evidence was that the alleged criminal activity was completed by February 2001, that Mr. Turner had received the insurance money and that Ms. Andrews had been paid the $1,000. That happened on February 1st, 2001.
Let me ask you, this is plain error also. Is that not
correct? I don't agree, Your Honor. I think the court could conclude that Mr. Silver objected to this because the issue of when the criminal conduct ended came up during the discussion of the statute of limitations defense. And he argued that, in fact, the criminal acts ended in February 2001. We've argued that preserved the objection through sentencing because the court had already decided that the criminal conduct ended in 2001. But, Your Honors, even if this is plain error, it would satisfy that standard. When you give someone an illegal sentence, it is a miscarriage of justice. And
the government points out the fact in its brief that the trial court said she thought about this and that this was 15 months was a reasonable sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor, but at the same time, she was beginning with the 2006 guidelines, and the record is clear on that. She started with the 2006 guidelines. She wanted to give the minimum sentence, and she gave the minimum sentence under the 2006 guidelines. If she'd been sentencing under the 2000 guidelines, the maximum sentence was 12 months, which was less than the minimum sentence under the 2006 guidelines. The range was 6 to 12 months, and it also would have moved the sentence into Zone B on the sentencing table and would have allowed a home detention instead of incarceration.
When you said, I was a little confused on the statute of limitations argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the merits. It sounds like she ends up saying that the statute of limitations passes muster because, at the very least, it was within 5 years of the last act. That is the indictment, not the other matters. I don't see her. Did she resolve the issue that you're talking about, that the acts of concealment don't count?
Not specifically that issue, Your Honor.
But that's the issue you have to win with, right? I mean, the question is whether the acts of concealment count under Grunewald, et cetera, right?
That's correct, Your
and
Honor.
She had not actually resolved that issue in the defendant's favor.
She had not resolved that issue, Your Honor. However, because she concluded that the criminal conduct the criminal conduct ended in 2001, which is what Mr. Silver argued at
that
point.
That's what I was wondering. Did she conclude that? Where is that?
The judge may not have said that, Your Honor. The argument was over when the criminal conduct
yes,
ended.
Yes, but obviously it would be plain error if the error would be plain if she had previously concluded that all criminal conduct had ended in 2001, and that's what perked me up here. But I don't see that.
Your Honor, even if you were to conclude that
get to the even if, you have a potentially winner argument here. If you could just tell me the page at which she concluded what you just said.
I don't think that she specifically concluded. Your Honor, that the criminal conduct ended in 2001. Even if you review for plain error, though, it's clear that this is a Grunewald indictment, and it's not, as the government claims, a Foreman indictment. Paragraph 8 of the indictment specifically charges that one of the objects of the conspiracy was to conceal the conspiracy itself and the acts in furtherance. And cases have held that that is the language that points to a Grunewald conspiracy, a Grunewald indictment. So these acts of concealment, which happened after they'd gotten the money under the government's theory, were part of the cover-up and not part of the conspiracy. And therefore, the criminal conduct ended in 2001.
You want to save?
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I'm Dan Patalis for the United States. With me at council table is Ann Brickley, also from my office. Your Honors, the briefing that we provided, I think, lays out our position fairly well on the Brady and sufficiency arguments.
I know. You didn't even want oral argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. We didn't think it was necessary. However, I'm happy to have the opportunity to answer your questions. I will say on the Brady issue just briefly. The defense shouldn't be allowed to have it both ways. A tactical decision in the trial court was made by experienced.
How about the government? They have it both ways?
How so, Your Honor?
Well, Harrison has been the law of the circuit for many, many years.
I don't think
the government knew of the notes and yet didn't turn them over, even though there was a court order prior to the start of trial.
Your Honor, we provide a formal statement of the witness's interview, especially one written the very day the interview occurred.
That's not Harrison.
I don't think Harrison actually answers this issue. Harrison was about preservation.
Yes, I know, but it talks about the impact of notes versus a written report.
There is discussion of that.
Yeah.
But I think the rule on Jenks clearly is that the notes aren't necessarily Jenks. It's when you have a formal written report of the agent.
We're talking about Brady.
Correct. And we disagree with the conclusion, as we said in our brief, with the conclusion of appellant that these notes contain any Brady or Giglio exculpatory impeachment information.
So do you disagree with counsel's statement that two of the four points made were not shown in the notes? I mean, your brief offers hypothetical testimony that Agent Robinson would have provided had she been confronted with her.
Right, and that's what I meant when I said they shouldn't be permitted to have it both ways, ask for plenary review, and yet make a tactical decision not to do anything about the notes after we did produce them. And again,
what I'm getting at is the prosecutor said the notes are identical to the final report and then confessed she hadn't even seen the notes. I think we have to be clear. Both parties have to play by the rules, right?
Oh, absolutely, there's no doubt, and the government's concedes that it has Brady obligations, certainly. Our point, Your Honor, is that.
So you're still arguing here that the notes were not Brady material?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, one thing, the argument of the defendant below, appellant on appeal, is that there was an omission in the notes. But, of course, notes necessarily have omissions because they're less, there are less.
Why are they not Brady?
They're not Brady because the formal written report does include, which was written based on the agent's recollection of this interview that same day.
What's your best case?
The best case for Brady? Actually, there's a Judge Wald opinion I was reading last night, I believe, on. I wish I could recall. It's with an N. Norberg.
It never served on the district court, so it must be an opinion of this
it's
court.
It's the point of this court. I don't think it's a. I want to be clear. I don't want to make an incorrect representation, but I think it dealt with the Jenks issue. So it may not.
I'm still focused on Brady.
Right. I think that a common sense reading of the notes next to the statement, the actual statement that was provided at the inception of discovery in this case.
You don't think a defense attorney could have impeached your witness had he had the notes?
Not at all. In fact, I think the defense counsel.
He couldn't have asked Agent Robinson where two of these so-called inconsistent statements came from.
Well, he could have asked that question. I think my point is it wouldn't have been exculpatory or impeachment when Agent Robinson was given the opportunity to respond about.
We don't know what she would have said.
Correct, and we don't know that because he didn't ask for more time. He didn't ask to call her. And remember, Agent Robinson was the case agent who was sitting at the table.
Why do you think courts keep issuing opinions talking about Brady material has to be provided to defense counsel in time to make appropriate use of the materials?
There's no doubt that there is a timeliness component to Brady. We don't dispute it. Our dispute lies with characterizing these notes as Brady at all. In this case, if this was a consolidated 302 after many interviews prepared months down the road, maybe there might be a reason for us to make
sure. I understand. I mean, you want to get to the second question. I'm at the first question.
Okay.
Namely, a government official prepares a report. The report makes 4 points. The government official based the report on some contemporaneous notes taken during the interview of the witness about whom the report is summarizing.
In part, she did, but she also based that report on her own totally valid recollection of the interview that occurred that same day.
Suppose, to take Judge Rogers' point,
certainly.
Suppose there had been a statement in the notes that was not in addition to that which, that was not, suppose the notes, instead of omitting something she testified to, had included a statement that was probably inconsistent with what Robinson testified to. Palpably inconsistent. Silver had gotten it and decided and did exactly what he did. What would our appropriate resolution of that case be?
The standard, I would argue, would be plain error. The resolution is a different question, of course, Your Honor. I think that there may be an issue there.
What do you mean? What would our appropriate resolution be? Would it be appropriate under those circumstances for us to reverse on the grounds it's a palpable Brady violation, even if counsel did not object or did not seek to cross-examine?
I think you can reverse on Brady issues.
No, should we?
Under plain error.
Yes.
And
could we?
You could.
Well, in that, what about that hypothetical? Should we?
Obviously, I don't want to avoid your question. I think you could. Whether you should, it's not what
isn't the question that we're talking about the timing question,
yes,
rather
right.
than the other question.
Right.
Now, in your case, we have somebody, were the notes taken on the same day as the report written up?
Correct.
All right. So, for example, right now I'm taking notes on what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I can promise you I'm not writing down everything. And partly I'm not writing down everything because if I did, I wouldn't be able to ask you this question.
That's right.
Right? So maybe in your situation where all that's missing, the only problem is something is missing, Mr. Silver, as an extremely experienced defense lawyer, realized maybe that if he actually asked Robinson this question, she would say not only
yes.
Is that the case? But let me repeat the story again in front of the jury about all the lies your client told.
Right.
So that he made a tactical judgment. While if in the other situation that Judge Silberman is proposing, that tactical judgment would be pretty weak, because then he would have a piece of paper to confront with. But it still strikes me both of these are ineffectiveness issues rather than Brady issues. The only question is whether he had enough time to do whatever damage he would be able to do. And that's why I think, seems to me, your better answer here is not, this is not potentially Brady, but that this is a tactical judgment somebody has to make at the moment. You should focus on the question of why this was timely or not timely. You want to do that? Why is this timely?
In other words, what Judge Garland is getting at and what I was getting at is counsel makes the
answer.
Yeah, all three of us are getting at it. Counsel made the argument if there's a Brady violation, doesn't matter what counsel does with it. We have an obligation to reverse. And so that's what...
So whether there's a Brady violation depends in part on the timing question, whether you provide somebody with enough time to make use of useful information.
Right. Your Honor, not only did the court inquire whether Mr. Silver wanted to cross-examine Agent Robinson, if he thought he didn't have enough time, he could have asked for more time. In fact, during the bench conference that was called when the issue of the notes came up the day before, it was Mr. Silver who first, the word overnight came out of his mouth. So he wasn't worried about getting them right then. He himself seemed to think that he could analyze them tomorrow morning and respond as needed. I guess the timing question also goes to why didn't we turn them over on February 7th or 16th when we turned over the rest of the discovery? The answer to that really lies in whether or not it appears to be Brady.
But the prosecutor hadn't seen the note.
Right, but the prosecutor...
And yet was saying that government had fully complied with its obligation under Brady.
We believe that it's... The prosecutor works with law enforcement agents who produced the report. There is no reason for the prosecutor to doubt the veracity of the agent when the agent hands us the report and says, this is the formal report of what was said in that interview.
Counsel,
I don't think...
We're talking about trial here. We're talking about Brady. Some sophistication going on here. Everybody knows. I mean, Judge Garland's hypothetical about how he's taking notes and they're not complete. We don't know what Agent Robinson's standard operating procedure is about how she takes notes. I mean, these are all issues that could have been explored had counsel had the notes in sufficient time to think about what he wanted to do with them. That's why I keep focusing on, and you're resisting all of us, is the timing point.
Your Honor, I think that my conclusion is that if this is the case that the court wants to hold, this shouldn't be the case that the court holds that rough notes routinely have to be turned over with formal 302s and reports of interviews.
Because
the court was in order for it to turn over and comply with Brady obligations. We believed we had. It's sort of a definitional circle, I'm afraid.
Excuse me, I'm having a little. I think there's a. Perhaps there's some difference between my two colleagues here. I thought, and I'm in agreement with Judge Rogers, that if these notes had a palpable contrast with the testimony, even if Silver had not pursued it, I think her question is, wouldn't it be plain error without even an argument of ineffective assistance of counsel?
I don't think
that's what I thought. That's what my question was getting to.
Right.
In other words, taking her line of questioning, suppose there is a flat contradiction in the notes, not an omission or but a flat contradiction. It's turned over, and for whatever reason, counsel decides not to pursue it. Wouldn't it be still plain error and a Brady violation?
Well,
I thought what Judge Rogers was getting at.
I mean, there's a difference, obviously, between reversible plain error and an error that is plain under the standard. You're asking, should it be reversible plain error?
Yes.
I can't really answer that because I think it turns on the effect it would have on the proceeding under the standard. I think you have to look at the effect it would have on the particular proceeding, and that requires you to consider the hypothetical effect.
Because counsel is arguing there's a certain supervisory authority on the part of the court if there's a palpable violation of Brady. That's what I detected in Appellant's argument.
I don't know.
I think that's what Judge Rogers is getting at. Am I correct?
I don't know that I'm in a position to answer that case, that question for all cases, because I really think
it's... Well, the Supreme Court said we don't have this kind of supervisory responsibility.
Yeah, right.
We don't have that authority. The only issue is, under Kyles and under Strickler, is whether it's material.
Right.
And material means it has to have a reasonable chance of affecting the outcome.
Right.
And the issue there, should the answer should be, I assume, it has to do with the timing, not with whether it's, you know, how useful it is. So we're back to the timing question. And I understand your view to be that if you give it to the if you gave it to him in that morning, even if it was devastating, he could have used it or not. And the other side is going to be arguing, no, it was too late.
I don't know how you resolve that question other than to say he certainly was given an opportunity in this case to make a reasonable conclusion. And I think if you actually look at the facts, you look at the notes in this case in the 302, it's hard to see his decision as other than a good tactical decision.
Assuming you can figure out what those notes say.
Right, and that's another problem with notes in general.
No, but I mean, I thought it was telling counsel, was it not, that appellant's counsel got up here and told the three of us that there were four statements. And we said, what's the four?
I'm sorry, just speaking for myself, my misunderstanding was based on reading the defendant's brief. I looked back, you did point out the defendant's did point out four. I had only realized that the defendant had noticed three.
Right, right. Another issue they spot is the timing of the repayment. That's correct. Your Honor, I think I'm well over my time, but I have a feeling that the...
Let me ask you just about the impact.
Certainly.
Looking at the closing argument of counsel, wasn't this the killer, the inconsistent statements?
As a matter of sufficiency.
No. Arguing to the jury. Here's a woman who's friends with a man. She has a check from him for $1,000.
That's true. There was also other evidence in the record.
Really?
Well, for one thing, I think the appellant ignores the record evidence that actually shows, this isn't like Tefra where Judge Wald was concerned about, you know, there was a lookout theory and there was...
What's the other evidence in this case?
The other evidence, Your Honor, is, first of all, there was evidence that Mr. Turner actually did have an accomplice in the relevant group. Pardon me?
The question is who?
Correct, but I think once you get to the fact that there is evidence that he used an insider, that's when all these other inferences and certain...
What was the government's devastating evidence, according to the prosecutor's own closing argument?
The devastating evidence was the check, was the fact that she was seen at the time of the...
That she was present, that she was a friend.
Right.
And she had a $1,000 check that said it was a loan.
Right.
Now, what's the devastating evidence, said the prosecutor to the jury?
She has the...
She gave these inconsistent statements to Agent Robinson. I mean, you can't fight the facts in this case.
I'm not trying to. Believe me,
right?
that is a key piece of evidence, but there's other...
If those inconsistencies weren't in the case, what do you have? You have opportunity, as a lot of other people.
Well,
friendship.
You have opportunity, certainly, but this is a narrow class of people. It's 10, 11, 12 people. You have the
what
check.
What other people could have done this?
Had the requisite knowledge to do it, but they didn't have the evidence of close association at the time in question.
They were friends.
Right, but you also have the testimony of Lorenza Mayer, the mother, who said she saw them together at the time, around the time of the death. So
they were friends.
Right, and Andrews knew about the death of the decedent. Therefore,
they were friends.
I don't disagree with that. That
no,
they were.
I mean, I'm just trying to say, at least the trial prosecutor thought the key thing was the inconsistent statements.
I think it was a significant piece of evidence when piled on top of the other evidence.
Anything else you'd like to argue?
I was prepared to address the Grunewald issue, if the court has any questions. I realize I'm out of time.
No, is there just anything you think you want to say to the court?
No, that's all, Your Honor.
Is there something
you.
In the indictment on the Grunewald question you wanted to respond, just on that one point?
I would just respond briefly, as this court did in United States versus Hitt, which I know Your Honor is very familiar with. You have to look at the totality of the statements in the indictment to determine the scope of the conspiracy. It's more than just paragraph 8. Furthermore, the defense's claim that paragraph 8 ends the question ignores the fact that Grunewald actually was remanded for further proceedings on a broader theory if the facts support it. So clearly, that language alone doesn't end the inquiry. I think with that, I can take my seat.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Counsel for appellant, you want to take another minute or 2 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Just very briefly, one point. Coming back to the Grunewald issue, Judge Garland, on transcript page 727, the government argued during the statute of limitations argument that there were several additional overt acts that occurred afterwards. The testimony of Agent Robinson shows that when Ms. Andrews provided her interview, I believe it was in 2005, she lied to the agent.
Wait, can you hold on just 1 second?
Yes, 727, yes, Your Honor. It's on Joint Appendix 120, transcript page 727.
Yes, go ahead.
Looking at line two.
Yeah.
He brings up the additional overt acts that happened after the check cashing, including that. Your Honor, on page 730, the judge is announcing her ruling, beginning at line two.
Yep.
She says, I think at least superficially, looks like in terms of the overt acts afterwards, as well as the cashing of the check, would place it beyond the time period for the indictment.
Okay, thank you.
That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement.